You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR. Today we've got a special broadcast. We're doing a special Disability Day broadcast today. You're listening to 3CR 855M on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online via the playback service. My name's Kieran, and I'm joined in the studio today with a very special guest, a comrade of mine. If you want to introduce yourself, cuz.
Ginnigar Nyangai, Nanyu Wambad M. Randall, Aji Naya Yagia, Aji Wurundjeri Wadia, Aji Nadia Adagi Yaya Yangadawu, Aji Nadia Adagi Nulungin Namiga. So hi everyone, my name is M. Randall. I'm a Yagga woman and I pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people in their land, and I remember my ancestors and my elders. And I'm a part of the Black People's Union, and I guess in like connection to today, I'm a peer worker, have lived experience of disability. And I also run Blackfella Alter Sioux. So, yeah, just here for a yarn.
Yeah, sounds deadly. And sounds deadly doing your intro in language.
Yeah.
Need to hear a lot more of that on this show.
Yeah, I think language is healing, and it's about spirit. And, yeah, I don't know, just if it makes you feel connected. I think when I started speaking language, it brought on a lot of healing for me. I think something that gets forgotten when it comes to disability is our spirit, and making sure our spirit is strong and connected. And I think language is one of those important ways to reconnect and stand strong. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it goes a long way to healing that intergenerational trauma as well. You know, something somebody I work with, Beck, she's another First Nations person. She talks a lot about how there's not just intergenerational trauma, but there's also intergenerational healing to be found in our culture and in practicing and revitalizing our culture.
Well, yeah, I'm the first in three generations to speak Yagir, and obviously I'm not fluent. I'm still like a baby when it comes to the language. But, you know, as like our elders have said, like even when you just say hello, that's healing. Like even if it's just one word a day, like it's better than nothing, and it keeps it alive. And I think I don't know who we are without our language.
Yeah.
And our language is tied to the land. So without our language, I think we lose a massive part, if not all of who we are.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And, you know, that's actually, I've got a few questions for you today, but that's actually a really great segue into the first question. So the theme of today is right relations. And along that line, you know, when you think about right relations, what does culturally grounded care look like for our mob, you know, especially for people who are living with different access needs?
I think these services need to be for mob and by mob. And you see it happening a little bit, but I don't think it's happening enough. I'm really sick of, there's this theme of white fellas trying to guess what we need, and or they might do like one co-design with like First Nations fellas, or they might do like one like steering group, but it's not enough, because at the end of the day they're still just guessing, and it obviously brings poorer outcomes for our people. Like co-design is not enough. We need to run our own services. But also I think when we talk about culturally grounded care and being in right relations, I'm probably going to like repeat this a lot throughout the show, but there's not going to be proper culturally grounded care and right relations until we can get our land back and our law back. Like existing in these systems is inherently disabling. Like it disables you, and then for mob who are disabled, it is extra disabling. Like there is no way to really truly survive and thrive in this colonial system. And I think we can do our best as mob to keep fighting and keep resisting in this system, but we're never going to know true healing until we get our land back. But I also think, I guess, side point, that there is a lot of healing in fighting for your land back and that resistance. Like, yeah. I think there's a lot of healing in that, to know that you're carrying on from past generations and you're carrying that fire for the future generations. Like, yeah, I think maybe sometimes as disabled people, we feel like we're not doing enough and we're not contributing enough, and that's that capitalist colonial mindset that makes you feel like if you can't have a job or if you can't study, then, you know, you're useless, you're slack. But I think every day we get up and we continue to resist, I think that's so important, and we need to remember that that's so worthwhile.
Yeah, definitely. And you also touched on something there as well about, like, the co-designing stuff, you know. At the end of the day, it's not self-determination when it's co-design. And, you know, what we need is to be able to determine our own affairs, and that means designing stuff ourselves, not some tokenistic little, you know, board that gives a bit of feedback that may or may not be even listened to and actioned.
But here's the thing. These white services think that co-design is self-determination. Yeah. They're like, here, look, we gave you this. You know, we're pushing self-determination. They don't even know what the word means. Yeah. Like, slack.
You know, I think as well, like, you know, again, like, that's just an excellent bridge to my next question, which is a bit about that sort of stuff. You know, like, you do a lot of work in peer support, and you've been organizing community spaces for years now, or at least, you know, years that I've known you. What have you seen our communities do well in actually supporting one another that colonial systems actually consistently failed to do?
So I'm in a really interesting position where I actually have three peer work jobs, and some one of those roles is actually within Queensland Health, and then the other role is Blackfella Alter Sioux. So, like, I'm working on, like,
both sides,
complete ends of each side. And it's been so eye-opening working within white systems. But then that's why Blackfella Alter Sioux is so important. Like, working in the white systems has reinforced to me why self-determinating services and grassroots services like Blackfella Alter Sioux and, you know, all the other deadly stuff mob are doing is so important. Peer work is inherently decolonial. I think some peer workers forget that, actually. Some peer workers I've found like to act like mini cops. But anyway, that's a yarn for another day. They get a little bit of power, and they, especially like working in like psych units, and like I've seen some peer workers like doing searches on patients, and I'm like, that's not your job. Like, you're getting a little power hungry. You think just because you went through it that now you've got that power that you can like punch down. It's actually really sad to see. But yeah, I feel like, yeah, peer work fits within Blackfella culture so well, because like our cultures are based on the value of lived experience, right? Like, our elders are everything to us because of the lived experience they've gained from their lives, and our cultures and all of our wisdom and our lore is built off lived experience because we're remembering from the past generations and bringing it down. So it fits perfectly.
Yeah.
Side note, I've actually been trying to translate peer work into Yigiya. I can't. And that's because I think we don't have words like that, because everyone was a peer worker. Like, everyone was using their lived experience to, and what they'd been through and that hope to support others through the same journey. Like, that was just our communities, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we continue to do that. Like, I think every Blackfella is a peer worker in a way. So, and there's something so special, even just working in like my Queensland Health job, about working with First Nations consumers, like we have to call them that, but, and just being able to, like, you can't decolonize Queensland Health. It doesn't work like that, but I just try and push it and like, just take like the women out for weaving and stuff, and just kind of like, yeah, do that sort of healing stuff that maybe a white clinical system wouldn't see as like, you know, doing your job.
Yep.
But that is our job, and that's been some of the most powerful moments, is just going to like the beach and just weaving. And yeah
definitely. And you know, I've seen similar sort of stuff as well. So you know, in my past I've had some jobs that I am and aren't proud of, but you know, I've worked in Aboriginal rehabs with a lot of our followers who were, you know, trying to battle addiction and stuff. And one of my first actual proper jobs was actually working in the jails. I wasn't a screw though, so don't judge me. But I worked in there, like doing a lot of like mental health programs and stuff. And you know, they've got their like rigid programs that they have that you're meant to do and stuff, but quite often the most not just the most fulfilling stuff for me, but like the most impactful stuff that I've done with the fellas in there was actually just around like culture, just getting together and having, you know, yarns and talking about culture and just, you know, being together in those cultural sort of ways. That's
you got to be real creative when you work in the white systems. And yeah, it's right. Like those things that maybe like a white clinician won't see as impactful end up being the most impactful because, again, these white clinicians don't understand us. And they don't understand what is healing for us. And that's, again, wrapping it back to self-determination, why we need to be able to do things our way.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, that's what's always got the best outcomes as well, self-determination. And there's been so many studies, not just here, but, like, around the world that actually show that self-determination is single-handedly the best thing for actually addressing people's needs. You know, when you come in, when somebody comes in, especially, like, with white settlers and whatever else, and they try and dictate to us what, you know, we should and shouldn't be doing to heal, you know, it's only ever so, it only has so much of an impact. But then when we can actually sit down and work out our own programs and run them ourselves and do it all ourselves, that's when we actually see the proper real results.
But that is colonialism, right? Like a white clinician telling a black fella how they should heal. Like that's colonialism, and they don't see it. They've got that white savior complex of, oh, look at us helping these blacks. But, you know, that's colonialism in action. That is in action in systems like Queensland Health and what do you call it down here? Health Victoria.
Yeah, Victoria. Yeah, and it's you know, it's colonialism, and it's also racism at the end of the day. It's actually a proper form of paternalistic racism. You know, that whole white saviorism concept. But, you know, along those lines, you know, how do relationships and kinships and stuff and, you know, that collective responsibility help shape the way that you approach your peer work?
Well, kinship and collective responsibility is the basis of peer work, especially First Nations peer work. Because in peer work, there's no helping, right? Like, you're not helping someone, you're walking in it together.
Yeah.
Like, we're in this together. I'm not going to do anything to you or for you. Like, we're going to come to a conclusion together about the work we're going to do, which, it's different in a sense because I'm not here to make decisions for you, which can be really shocking for people who have been in health systems where it's just been clinicians, especially white clinicians, doing things to them and making decisions for them and saying, here's what we're going to do, you're going to do this, especially if they've been on something like an involuntary treatment order where they've had all their, you know, their rights taken away essentially for being disabled. So peer work can, like, I remember when I first met my first peer worker, I was in a psych ward in Logan. And I was like shocked. I was like, so you're not gonna make any decisions for me? And they were like, no, you guide this. And I was just like, I'm gonna need a moment. Like, this is wild. And obviously, you can't do true peer work in a psych facility, right? Like a psych ward, because there's still the involuntary treatment orders, which means that there's a power imbalance because. Yeah. Peer work, like the power balance is a massive part of peer work because usually you've got the clinician up here and you've got the patient down here. And peer work drives to kind of level that playing field. But the playing field's never going to be level when you're working somewhere like a psych unit, right? Because at the end of the day, you can't leave. So you end up, peer work in psych facilities is often just trying to do the best you can, but it's not true peer work. Like true peer work can only exist in like I guess like grassroots settings where there's both equally consensual, you know, both people equally want to do it. They're not being like, because I guess in the psych unit the clinicians kind of go, hey, go talk to the peer workers, go, you know, so like it's not entirely their decision.
Yeah, it sort of strips away that autonomy.
Yeah, so yeah, peer work kind of flips the script when it comes to not like, I guess, other, I mean, I wouldn't call peer work treatment. I'd hate that word. It's a relationship.
Yeah.
But it flips the script, which I think is healing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, along those lines too, you know, what do you reckon it would look like if services and supports actually respected First Nations ways of caring, relating and responding to distress?
I mean, for starters, places like prisons and psychiatric wards would not exist.
Yeah.
Because they go against our ways of care, but also just appropriate ways of responding to distress and conflict. Like, locking people away doesn't fix things.
Yeah.
Forcing people to take medication they don't want to take doesn't fix things. And, you know, how many of our people have taken their own lives in prisons and psych facilities that were supposed to, and I'm doing air quotes, look after them and keep them safe, when really that being contained and being taken away from everything you know drove them to even darker depths than when before they even got in there, you know. We need to abolish prisons and psych facilities. It's interesting. I hear when people talk about abolition sometimes that they think that prisons should be replaced with psych wards, because it's like, oh, well, the people in prisons, they're just mentally ill, so they just need to go on an involuntary treatment order. They don't need to go to prison. And it's like, involuntary treatment orders are a form of incarceration. Psych wards are prisons. If you can't get to the door and leave without being chased by a police officer, you are in a prison.
Yeah.
And so more psych facilities is not the answer to getting rid of prisons. We need to, like, be more creative, you fellas. Come on. Like, you know, like, why would we replace, like, one site of incarceration with another?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I'd love to obviously see the abolition of prisons and psych facilities and there be actual liberation and freedom and actually appropriate ways of responding to distress. And I think peer work is a big part of how we could be responding to distress, because there's something so powerful about when you're in like a dark place and there's someone there that gets it. Like, just the power of someone being like, I get it, I've been there and I actually got out of it, and every day is not perfect, but, you know, this is not the end. Like, that, just that in itself, and just having someone there, you know. But yeah, we need the self-determination to run our own services, and yeah, get rid of the prisons and the psych wards.
Yeah,
burn them.
Yeah. And I just want to just reiterate what you said as well about, like, you know, psych wards, they are forms of incarceration. Now, at the end of the day, if some sort of institution strips away your freedom, strips away your autonomy, you know, that's a jail just by another name.
Yeah.
You know? It's no different to how they rebranded jails as rehabilitation centers. You know, it's the same thing at the end of the day. You know, it's just a different pool of funding or whatever that funds it, and it's just got a different name. But if it looks like a chook and acts like a chook, it's a chook.
Yeah, know? Exactly. Yeah. But I think people don't... I don't think people have the same empathy for people with what is classed as severe mental illnesses. Like, I'm going to go out on a limb here and be honest that I live with schizoaffective disorder, which is when schizophrenia and bipolar have a horrible little baby. And I have lived experience of involuntary treatment orders. And people... schizophrenia, people are really scared of that word. Like, yeah. You say that word, it's like, boo. Like, yeah, yeah. You know, and they'd never, I feel like once you, you know, see that, like, they never talk to you again. Like, I tell people that and they've suddenly got a story about how they got robbed by a schizophrenic on crack. And I'm just like, I didn't need to know that story. But that's so people with schizophrenia are like the boogeymen, right? So people, I'm going to be just blunt, people don't really care what happens to people with schizophrenia and bipolar, like people who are experiencing manic episodes. Very similarly to the fact that people don't care about people who go to prisons because, well, you're a criminal, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah.
So there's not, like, the abolition of prisons and psych wards and stuff are not front on people's mind because they don't care.
Yeah.
They go, well, I don't want you in my community. I don't want to live next to a schizophrenic. It's like, you probably do live next to a schizophrenic. You just don't know. Like, yeah. So there's just that lack of empathy that's really, you know, right throughout society. And, like, you know, I talk about my lived experience and people go, oh, well, but, you know, you needed to be locked up. You know, you needed that. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't care.
No, they don't. And, you know, you're right. It's that whole thing about, you know, these people, it's kind of like a whole Karen mentality of, you know, they just want to be, you know, I'm using my air quotes now, you know, safe in community. But, you know, that's not being in community, you know, locking people up. That's not being in community. And you're right, there's this whole, like, boogeyman sort of a thing to it where, you know, people think that people who have certain mental health conditions or people who have, you know, previously offended or something like that, that, you know, the, I'm using my air quotes, the safest thing to do is to lock them up somewhere. But that's not how you build community. That's not how you function in community. And at the end of the day, all you're doing is persecuting segments of your population.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely disgusting.
But again, it comes down to that white mentality that they don't care. What they want is a white community.
Yeah,
They want the white Australia policy.
Yep.
They just want little white families that, you know, there's no complexity, there's no... White people are so boring, right? Like, they don't want any like thing that makes life interesting, or they don't want to meet people that, you know, have different lived experiences. They just all want the same house and the same family, and everyone's had the same. Like, I'm sorry, I'm bored, and it's weird, and it doesn't make sense to me. Like,
yeah.
I guess being a peer worker, like, that you live with that curiosity, and like, I love the people that I get to meet, right? Because I meet people that I would have never met otherwise, and everyone has a different story and has different complexities in their life, and it's an honor to be brought into that, and that, you know, to be a part of that journey, even if it's just for a little while. Like that, that's the beauty of life, right?
Yeah.
And white fellas just don't want it. No. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I suppose as well, like, we're 25 minutes past 12 here. You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR. I'm in the studio here with friend and comrade of mine, Em, who's done a lot of work in grassroots spaces and peer work spaces. So, you know, along those lines, you know, you have been a part of grassroots Blackfella-led programs like Blackfella Alter Sioux. You know, what actually inspired that space, and what kind of innovations came from the community itself?
Yeah, so I have a lived experience of suicide, and I mean, I didn't succeed because I'm here, but I have a lived experience of suicidal ideation and attempts. And I obviously also knew that, like, obviously suicide is a massive problem for our peoples.
Mm.
You know, because it was never really a thing for our people, and then it hit us really hard.
Yeah.
And then I think do we have the highest rates in the world?
Yeah, yeah,
or we're
do.
Up there?
No, we do. We have the highest rates in the world, not only as a general population, but we've also got the highest rates for women, for men, and for children in the world. And, you know, as you said, it's not something that's a part of our culture. Like, I know in my language and a few other languages I've looked at, we didn't even have a word.
We don't have a word.
Yeah, there's no such thing as suicide before colonization. Like, it was just not even thought of. We didn't have a word for it because it was so foreign and, you know, such a not a thing for us. And now we've got the single highest rates in the world for all of our demographics. And it's something as well that's only happened over the last couple of decades.
Yeah.
Like, even as recently as, I think it was like 1950 or something like that, our suicide rates were still pretty much zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, but now, yeah, the worst in the entire world. And I think it's only getting worse as well. Every time I look at the stats, it's absolutely disgusting.
And I think it kind of looks at that, like, compounding of colonialism. Like, every generation that goes by, like, the colonialism gets compacted.
Yeah.
And also, I guess... The colonialism has like, it's the same thing, but it's kind of changed forms a little bit, and it's hard to keep up with and to have that hope, right?
Yeah.
So with Blackfella Alter Sioux, obviously I have a lived experience, and I knew a lot of other mob with lived experience, and I knew obviously that we have the highest rates in the world, and I'd had histories of grassroots organizing, being a part of the Black People's Union for like 3 years, I think. I think Blackfella Alter Sioux's been running for about 2 years. But I actually went back home to our women's camp, and I remember talking to like all my different aunties, and pretty much every auntie had a story about a son who was in jail or was struggling with alcohol and other drugs or was struggling with their mental health. And stories about how, like, back on country, the closest psych ward is Lismore Hospital, which is a couple hours away. And stories about how, like, they'd be taken by the police to Lismore Hospital and then they'd be left there with no way home. Mm-hmm. You know, stories like that. And I was just like, I got to do something, because it's about that right relations, right, and that collective responsibility. Like, you know, my aunties are telling me these stories. You can't just sit there on your hands, right? Like, you got to do something. So I thought, okay, I got to do something. And then I was in Maganjin in Brisbane, and as I was becoming a part of the peer work world, I wasn't a peer worker yet, but I was engaging in a lot of peer work. I was engaging with a deadly organization called Brook Red, which is all peer work run. So there's no clinicians or anything. They're all peer workers, which it just really creates like a different sort of service.
Yeah.
Because there's none of that clinical, you know, clinicians act like cops, really. Yeah. Like that's so... to have no clinicians really was that like sense of safety. And they ran a program called Alt to Sue, or Alternatives to Suicide. Alt to Sue actually started in Turtle Island in, you know, so-called America, and was brought over here. And Alt to Sue is essentially like just a space with some values of those peer work values of, you know, responsibility to, but not for or over, like, you know, no one's responsible for the decisions you make. Essentially, it's a space where you have a yarn and you have a cuppa, and it's the facilitators are all people with a lived experience of suicide, and people who are struggling with suicide come and you just have a yarn. But what makes Alt to Sue different is that you cannot call an ambulance or the police or a mental health service on anyone in the group. So there's that, you know, that sense of safety that, because, you know, there's that feeling like you're going to talk about being suicidal and then they're going to call the cops on you and then you're going to get put on an involuntary treatment order and then you're going to be even more suicidal and you can't leave. So to enter a space where everyone agreed, no one's calling the cops, and also just that confidentiality that what's yarned about in the group stays in the group, like that was such a transformative space. It was the only time I'd ever really felt like I could talk about suicide, and that I was truly going to be safe, and that I was going to talk about what I want to talk about, and then I can get in my car and drive home, and I'm not going to have to spend the night in the psych ward.
Yeah.
So I loved that, and that it was a group, like obviously it was still like settlers, so it wasn't, you know, perfect, but they did really acknowledge like racism as like they acknowledge, Alt to Sue acknowledges that suicide is an appropriate response to what's happening in the world, whether that be capitalism, colonialism, you know, patriarchy, all those sorts of things, like that you're not sick, like living in this world makes you suicidal quite easily.
Yeah.
And I loved that framework, right, of not seeing it as a sickness and a disease, you know, like it's actually a pretty reasonable response to the world we live in. But still, like, I was the only black fella that would attend the group. And so it was kind of like I just felt that we needed a space for our own, and I had no idea how I was going to do that. But I knew that we needed our own space, you know, that self-determination. So I ended up, you know, kind of putting a little, like, call out on Instagram. I was expecting, like, 5 likes. But I basically was like, hey, who would like to run a group on Zoom for mob to yarn about suicide? And I got so blown away that I had to be like, we've got enough facilitators. Thank you. But that showed me, this is like, oh, and even people who weren't like wanting to be facilitators, they were like, oh, I've been waiting for something like this to pop up. And so I was like, okay, all right, well, I'm on the right track then. And then we got our facilitators together, which are obviously all mob with a lived experience of suicide. And Brook Red, the same organization I was talking about before, trained us up for free, which was like really solid, and I very much appreciate that. Kate, if you're listening, thank you. And then from there, it was important to me that the groups ran on Zoom, because I come, like, my mob is quite a rural community. It's not remote, but, like, you know, kind of out in the sticks. And there's no access to services. Like, there's no access to services in the city, really, even. But then especially, like, I was thinking of rural and remote mob when I put Blackfella Alt to Sue together, because there's nowhere to go. So to be able to just hop on Zoom, and, like, it doesn't matter where you are. Like, if you're in the Torres Strait, or you're in Alice, or you're in Darwin, it doesn't matter where you are. If you're in Melbourne, it doesn't matter where you are. You can Zoom in and connect. So, yeah, so that's how it works. We have, yeah, so two facilitators run each group, and you can just hop on Zoom and come spin a yarn. And we have people who have, like, a direct lived experience of suicide. So they've been suicidal themselves, or they've been a loved one of someone who's suicidal. But because of, we kind of extended a little bit that if, like, you know, loved ones who have lost someone, because usually Alt to Sue groups will say that it's only allowed for people who have a personal direct lived experience of suicide. But I didn't like that, because I don't think that really reflects the way that suicide affects our communities. Yeah. And if you've lost a loved one to suicide, you need somewhere to come and have a yarn too. So we kind of extended the rules a little bit so that anyone who just wants to have a yarn about suicide can come and have a yarn. It's usually mostly people with a direct lived experience, but we're kind of open to everyone. And we're 16 plus. I wish we could, because I know that, like, we're having, like, the suicide rates of, like, really, like, kids. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of one of my goals to be able to, figure out, like, without getting into legal trouble, how I can, like, extend that age gap, which I'm working on. But, yeah, so we run on Zoom. One of my goals actually is to support, like, communities, because sometimes you want to hop on Zoom, but sometimes you want to leave the house and go have a cuppa.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of my goals is to, like, kind of support communities to run their own Blackfella Alt to Sue groups, because I don't live in your community. I don't know what you want, but I'll support you to come and run one in person. So if anyone's listening and they would like to run a Blackfella Alt to Sue group in their own community, you can hit me up on Blackfella Alt to Sue on Instagram, or just hit up 3CR and they'll figure out how to get the message to me, I'm sure. But, yeah, so that's Blackfella Alt to Sue, and we've been running for 2 years, and I'm still figuring lots of things out. I'm good at peer work. I'm not very good at admin, so I've been trying to figure that out. But I do, like, yeah, I kind of plan on running Blackfella Alt to Sue, or having it running for the rest of my life.
Yeah,
I don't really, like, this is a long sprint. And sadly, in my lifetime, I don't think there will not be a need, but hopefully Blackfella Alt to Sue can be part of that healing our peoples. Yeah,
there's a couple of things as well that you touched on in that, which I think is really important, in particular, like, how you talked about the need for a service where you can be safe, you know, you can approach the service and not have to worry about that service calling the cops on you, or getting you involuntarily admitted, or, you know, something along those lines, which is, you know, as you said, it's only going to make things worse at the end of the day. It's not actually going to help. And, you know, those sort of services are so important, because, you know, not just with, like, suicide, but, like, with a whole range of things. You know, I know so many mob that are in a horrible position, but they're so afraid to reach out for help, because the services that do exist, so many of them just compound your situation and make it even worse. You know, like, even stuff that's got nothing to do with health, you know, like stuff like housing, for example. You know, if you're homeless and you got kids, you go into the Department of Housing to ask for help. Next second, you got Department of Child Services called on you. You know, it's just all those compounding things that only make it worse. And as a result, you know, so many mob are afraid to look for help, because they know it's not actually going to be help at the end of the day. And it's so important that you've got that, I reckon. Another thing as well that you said that I reckon is something that is so understated is that community responsibility to look after each other. And, you know, that's something that's always been a part of our culture, always been a part of our, you know, traditions and the way that we live as First Nations people before colonization. But it's something that, you know, these European communities just, you know, they don't know how to do. They don't know how to have that community responsibility for each other.
And it's different, right? Because, like, it's not responsibility like over. Like, it's not like I'm here to tell you what you can do. It's a collective responsibility to, like, it's hard to explain in, like, English, right?
But, yeah, I know what you mean. And, it's something that, you know, we all need to, you know, when I say all, I mean, like, everyone that lives here, everyone needs to start learning how to actually do and practice. But, yeah. Thanks for sharing about all that as well. And just again, to plug that Instagram page, it's Blackfella Alter Sioux. Actually, just real quickly, before we move on, just along those lines, is there ways that non-mob can help? Like, do you need, like, for example, like, funding or, you know, like, donations? Or is there, like, stuff that people that want to help but, you know, don't have that lived experience and aren't mob, is there ways that they can contribute?
Can I swear?
No, okay,
because it's radio. Okay,
cheers for us.
Okay, well, I'm real hard headed. I'm sure you can figure out the word I was going to put after that. And so I knew, I was like, we're never going to take any colonial funding.
Yeah.
We're never going to take, you know, any government fund. And also because a lot of suicide prevention. So I had my air quotes there too, because Blackfella Alter Sioux is not actually a suicide prevention program, because at the end of the day, I don't have responsibility over you.
Yeah.
Sad as it is, if you leave the group and you choose to take your life, that's actually not something that I... Like, I can't make that decision for you. I hope that coming to the group brought you some connection and I guess support, maybe gave you some hope and that connection. But I can't choose what you do. And that's that self-determination, right? Like, I can't make decisions for you. And sadly, if that's the decision you choose to make, you know, like, as sad as it is. So we're not a suicide prevention program, and suicide prevention funding has very intense, what's the word, like, parameters about, like, you know, you need to call the cops if you think someone's going to take their life. You need to blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not doing that, because if I take that funding, then I have to change what Blackfella Alter Sioux is.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, you're on.
And then what's the point?
Yeah.
So because I'm hard-headed, I'm running off my own pocket. So if any settlers would like to give us some bungu, I'm not going to argue with that. We don't actually, like, have a formal donation process set up, but if you reach out to us on social media and you'd like to support us, then, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Sounds good. Yeah, so we've touched on it a bit so far. You're listening to a... Special Disability Awareness Day broadcast on Yilliman on 3CR, 855 on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online via the playback service. Today we're talking about, you know, what right relations and innovations look like from a First Nations perspective, and, you know, from that lived experience that we have as First Nations people. So, you know, along those lines of lived experience, you know, how would you say that your own lived experience has shaped the way that you understand care, safety and healing? I mean, you've already touched on it a fair bit, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things was, I really need a cough. How do I cough?
Yeah, yeah, just go.
Just cough? Yeah. All right, give me a second, you mop.
You listen to 3CR. This is Billy X. Jennings of the Black Panther Party. Power to the people.
All right, we're back. Just had to have a good cough. You know how it is. So I think one of the, like, most radicalizing experiences, like, with my lived experience was being on an involuntary treatment order. I think that the lived experience of incarceration really just, like, shows you, like, it shows you what it's like to be in the bottom of the barrel of the world, right? Like, yeah, and then, yeah, and that being treated, like, when you live with, like, quote-unquote severe mental illness, you do get treated like a criminal, right? Like, you get your rights taken away. You get told what you can and can't do. And then that there's this thing, like, once you've been on an involuntary treatment order and you're accessing services, you're never looked at the same way, right? Like, you're never seen as trustworthy. You've never... I don't know. Like, you just kind of, like... lose you lose your humanity.
Yeah.
And then there's like something about being forced to take medication. Like I always say, like, because after you're on an involuntary treatment order in hospital, you're often put on a community treatment order, which is like essentially like a psychiatric ankle bracelet. Like you have to go in every week. You have to get your injections or take your medication.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was this thing where, like, I couldn't go back to country for years because I had to go in every week for my community treatment order and I wasn't allowed to leave Queensland. And my mob is in northern New South Wales. So just things like that, like the fact that all – and, you know, there was some First Nations workers and they were like, she really needs to go back to country. She's not going to get better if she doesn't go back to country. And they were like, no, too risky. Everything's about risk. So, yeah, obviously, like, having – I think there's, like, beautiful things that I've learned from my lived experience too, like having, like, experiences of, like – psychosis and stuff can really teach you about like creativity and like looking at things from a different lens. Like I really think that like my experiences of psychosis really helped with my like abolitionist thinking as well. Like apart from like my like abolitionist thinking coming from my lived experience of incarceration, it also like that creativity and looking at things in a different way. And you know, there's something like beautiful about experiences of mania. Like, do you know how much Black People's Union stuff I've done in a manic episode? Like, I'm an absolute machine when I'm manic. And like, you know, people may, you know, have opinions on that. But, you know, there's, I think that's just the general theme of disability, right? Like, there's beautiful things that come with it and I wouldn't change it for the world. Like, I would definitely like prefer if I was never put on an ITO. But like, if I had to change whether I had schizoaffective or chronic pain, I wouldn't change it because it has made me who I am.
Yeah.
And it has taught me so many things. And yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's something as well that I've noticed a lot with like Aboriginal communities in general. Like, you know, I used to live out on the mission and stuff like that. And, you know, adding those sort of communities and spaces, you know, it's not a case of like, oh, you know, so-and-so has got such and such wrong with them or whatever, as it might be seen in white society. It's very much like, you know, that's just who they are. That's
yeah.
a part of who they are. You accept, you know, that's who they are and you accept them for who they are sort of thing. And
I've never been judged by mob.
Yeah.
Never been judged by mob for my disabilities.
Yeah.
Always been settlers.
Yeah. Yeah. And, sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
That's all right.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to add on as well, like, you know, you're talking about how you've done so much work when you're, you know, like, feeling a bit manic and stuff. People might be familiar with a lot of, like, the zines and stuff I've produced and that I'm currently writing a book and stuff. All that happens when I'm in, like, that autistic ADHD hyper-focus mood.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I didn't make those. I've got, like, 10-plus zines and, you know, I didn't make them over weeks or months. I pumped out them in, like, 2 days because I was just in a hyper-fixated mood and just on the laptop just smashing them out.
And, I love
you know,
it.
Yeah. It's how it happens, I suppose. But yeah, you're also an artist as well.
I am.
I wondered if you wanted to talk a bit about that. In particular, you know, how does art help you express or make sense of your experience?
Well, yeah, and what I forgot to say before that I think, like my experiences of, like, mania and depression and psychosis and all those things have, like, made me the artist that I am, and they've brought me so much creativity. Like, I used to do a little bit of art when I was a teenager, but when I actually was in psych ward in Logan and I just started doing art because I was so bored. I was so bored. And so I just started doing art and I started doing stippling, and I'd never done stippling before. I don't know why I chose to do stippling, but as it, the beauty of mental health, that's, I just started doing stippling. And
so what is stippling?
Oh, stippling is, it's like when you make like, a wider art piece with lots of tiny dots. Like, the piece, you know how I've showed you like the old Aguri weapons and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's stippling. Oh, it was actually so crack up though, because one of the white nurses came up to me and was like, oh, you're doing dot painting. And I was like, oh, wow. I was like, it's not dot painting. My mob don't do dot painting. Oh, my gosh. It's stippling. Like, yeah, dumb. Anyway. And, yeah, I guess from then on I've done lots of art. Like, I ended up doing, like, I think when I was in hospital, I think I did, like, a stippling drawing of, like, a dandelion, because they change forms, and also they're like kind of good for the ground because they bring in is it nitrogen, I think it's called, and they like break up the soil and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And ever since then I've just been doing lots of art, and I like doing art that like bridges like blackfella like things with like disability. Like I remember not too long ago I did a drawing of like a wheelchair that said like land back on the back or something like that sort of thing, like bringing them together. And I think there's something very healing about art, and I'm a weaver as well. And I think that's been really healing as well. Like it's that mindfulness, but also being able to like, I create baskets and then I give the bungu to mutual aid because I don't need the money. And to be able to like create something and do what like our old women used to do and then be able to give that back to community, I think that's like really special.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and along those lines, do you think that art and storytelling can play a bit of a broader role in disability justice movement for our people?
I think like art is such a central part of our cultures, like our weaving and our painting and our songs and our dances. Like we are such an artistic people, and like that makes up such a massive part of our culture. And also disabled people are incredibly creative, and disabled blackfellas are some of the most creative people I've ever met in my life, because when you can't engage in the world in other ways, then you're kind of, art gives you a way to engage in a way on your terms, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, you think like, you know, movements are driven by art. Like there's so many movements that wouldn't exist without art, because art is what inspires people. Like you need the doctors and the people who do their jobs and whatever, but art is what inspires people and what like
enriches the soul.
Yeah, it engages their spirit. Like I've been so inspired by, you know, by art when other things like that should be logically inspiring weren't particularly inspiring, but then you look at it in like an art form and suddenly it clicks. Like it's just a different way of looking at things. And especially for me, like I think my experiences with psychosis have really like influenced my art, because you look at the world and you see the world in a different way. And yeah,
definitely. We've got about 10 minutes left on the show, just over 10 minutes. There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask, more about just like looking forward from, you know, this point onwards. So for you, you know, what does a future look like where people in distress are actually met with care, you know, not with police or punishment or coercion?
I mean, yeah, obviously abolishing police and prisons and psych units. And I think peer work really is, I feel like I can't overstate how important the role of peer work is. Like we don't need people who went to university to tell us how to heal.
Yeah.
Like they can be useful on the sidelines, but what you really need is people who lived it and got through it. And so I guess I see like communities of peer work, like more grassroots, like peer work organizations where people can engage on their own terms, and That's the future that I see, and I'd love to see. I'm such a yapper about blackfella peer workers. We need more. We want more, and especially peer workers working in their own communities. Because if peer work is about lived experience, then a massive part of your lived experience is the community you live in, right?
Yeah.
So, like, because I've seen jobs for, like, they're trying to get peer workers out into Cairns and the Cape and Torres. And it's like, that's not, I'm not far North Queensland mob. Why on earth would I go up there and try and do peer work with them fellas? Yeah. That's not my lived experience. I don't know them. Like what we need to do is support peer workers from the, like people who want to be peer workers from that community to support their own communities. Like why are we flying, even if they're a blackfella, why are we flying them here all around town? Like it doesn't make sense to me. Like your lived experience is a part of the community you live in.
Yeah.
So trying to get peer workers from other places into these. It's the same thing as like they fly the nurse in for 6 months and then they get to leave. Like there's, drives me crazy. That we also have problems with the fact that there's a Cert 4 in peer work that you can do at TAFE and stuff, and so it's becoming the industry standard that you need to do that Cert 4, even though it's incredibly flawed. And like I did it and I don't regret it, but it's so ableist to be like, if you want to be a peer worker, you have to go and study for a year and then do 80 hours of placement. Like, makes me wild. So I don't really like what, there's kind of almost this like professionalization of peer work happening where they're trying to like make peer workers like bump them up and be like, they're just as professional as clinicians. And it's like, no, that's not why we're here. We're not, I don't want to be a professional. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to just connect with people and support them the best way I can. I don't care about being fancy. It doesn't bother me. But in a wider sense, like I said before, like land back, because how, like we can do all these things, but without land back and without law back, with like, we're not actually going to be able to ever properly thrive and survive. And I think like there will never be like a true disability justice if this colony continues to exist, because it doesn't just disable blackfellas, it's disabling everyone.
Yeah,
like this colony is not good for you. Like that, this colony is poison.
Yeah,
it's not good for you. Like, you know, burn the colony, use it to keep us warm. I think we just, yeah, I was saying in the car, hey, that I think, like, it's interesting because I live in a regional town, and I think it's interesting how people, like, in Melbourne, I can imagine living in the city, like, it's easy to get your eye off the prize and, like, forget, because you get so caught up in, like, this, like, bustling city life. Yeah, everything going on. I think we just need to keep our eye on the prize and remember where we're going, you know, like, every day when you're getting ready for work or school or getting the bubs ready, just remember what we're fighting for. We're fighting for land back. We're fighting for the end of the colony. You know, this colony can't continue to exist. It just cannot.
Yeah.
And yeah, we just have to remember that and keep our eye on the prize.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's really about addressing like the underlying cause for the need for peer workers and
all
the issues in the first place. Yeah. You know, we can, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, peer work's amazing and stuff, but now, we could have all the peer workers we want, but essentially what we want is for them to not have to exist in the first place, because we have addressed the issues, which is colonialism and the fact that our land is occupied and our people are subjected to this sick system.
And, you know, that's the thing. Like, I think, you know, I think about getting my land back all day, every day. Like, I cry about it. It's probably influenced some suicidality. I'm not sure I would be as disabled as I am if I actually had my land back and this colony didn't exist. Like, I think people, maybe settlers, don't realize, like, it's just like this deep pain that you can't put into words. It's like really deep in your chest. Like, and so to live with that and to live in this colony, like, it is disabling. Yeah,
definitely. Well said. We've got about 5 minutes left on the program. Do you have anything else you wanted to like talk about or plug or?
I don't know. I mean, if you're a black fella and you want to be a peer worker, I say go for it, because we need more of us. And it's a part of our culture, and yeah, it's a very fulfilling job. So if you're thinking about it, I mean, you can talk to me about it if you want. I don't mind. I'm always happy to like really push like and support people to do peer work. And if you're thinking of doing something like Blackfella Ulta Sue, like do it, because like there's so many other spaces like out of suicide, like AODS and like grief and even like psychosis, like hearing voices, like that sort of thing. Like, so if you're thinking about it, like it's scary, but like it's so worth it.
Yeah.
You know, stop waiting for the colony to do it. Because they won't do it, and if they do it, they'll probably just cause more damage.
Yeah.
So definitely. If you want to be a peer worker, I would say go for it. It's hard to work an actually fulfilling job where you feel like you're making change in this capitalist system. But I think to be able to strip like things back right down to like equal relationships and just connecting with a person. Like it's very fulfilling, and you know, I can't picture ever not doing peer work. Like yeah. even if I don't do it paid, like there's ways to be a peer worker for free. Like I mean, like not doing it as a job, like
yeah.
even just supporting your own community and yeah. stuff. Yeah.
And it's such a integral part of, you know, what community actually is as well. And, you know, getting involved with peer work stuff, it's about, you know, it's not just about like helping the community, it's about building that community and
yeah.
you know, that community existing, and you know, just all the stuff that we've been missing so sorely for the past 127 years of occupation.
And the way peer work rolls on, like, you know, if I hadn't connected with that, like, you know, it is not good that I was in hospital, like, on involuntarily, but if I hadn't connected with that peer worker and they hadn't, you know, peer worker rolls on and it's almost like it's not quite intergenerational, but, like, that person survived something and they became a peer worker and I met them and used what I survived to become a peer worker. And so peer workers kind of create more peer workers, if they that makes sense, because like that support kind of bolsters people up to then do it themselves. And then so you're building and you're empowering your community and you're building strength and resistance in your peer work is resistance. It's saying that I survived and I'm going to use that wisdom and what I learnt for the betterment of my mob or my wider community. Like peer work is resistance.
Well said. And you know, at the end of the day, that's what we need to be doing. You know, we need to be resisting the colony in whatever ways that we have available to us. And you know, as you're saying, like one of the best and, you know, not necessarily easiest, but one of the best ways to do that is to, you know, get involved with peer work and start building up your community, building up your nation, so that we can actually properly resist this colony.
Peer work is nation building.
Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, it is at the end of the day, though.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we need. That's how we're going to overcome this colony. We're not going to do it fighting little individual battles or, you know, speaking at a rally or on a panel or something like that. We're going to do it by actually, like, building our community and building our nations so that we've got that power to be able to, you know, take affairs back into our own communities and, you know, start determining our own futures as we have been for millennia before we were occupied.
True God.
Yeah. All right. You've been listening to Yilliman on 3CR. We've been doing a special episode today for Right Relations and Innovations. It's the International Day of People with Disability today, 3rd of December. And I've been in the studio with a friend and comrade of mine, Em. Pardon me.
Oh. We're all coughing. Yeah.
Those dodgy chop chop ciggies. So you know, just to plug those Instagrams again, there's Blackfella Alter Sue on Instagram. You know, if you want to hear more, if you want to get involved in peer work, if you want to reach out and see how you can start building those peer work groups in your own community, hit Em up via the Instagram page. And if you got any money as well, you know, if you're a settler and you got deep pockets, donate, because like at the end of the day, you know, these things do cost money, whether it's, you know, being able to like go out and have a cuppa with mob, or whether it's, you know, paying stuff like our fees for Zoom so that, you know, we can have a proper Zoom account and not one that gets cut off after half an hour or whatever. I need to wait for a conversation, and you know, all these little things cost money at the end of the day. And you know, we are heavily impoverished in this colony, so if you got the money, please do share it. That's a wrap for the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No, thanks for coming on, sharing everything. It's been a really great yarn, a really great discussion. Probably one of the best episodes I've had this year, I reckon.
True God. Oh, yeah. My God. Thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah, and if you've missed most of the show, if you've only just tuned in, we're going to aim to get this show up on the website ASAP. You can find it freecr.org.au/Yilliman. Until next week, have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.